Welcome to Steppin' Out of Babylon, produced by Sue Supriano. Babylon is everywhere. It's the isms and schisms not only within the system, but within ourselves. Let's unify, stand aligned, and step out of Babylon. Hi, everybody. My name's Sue Supriano, and my guest today is Willie Underbaggage. Willie's from Pine Ridge, South Dakota. He's a Lakota, Native American from the Lakota. I never know whether to say tribe. How about it, Willie? Is that not a good thing to say, or is that okay?
It's okay, because it is a tribe. Mm-hmm. But also, when we think about tribes in the United States, we always think about nations, because each tribe has a unique language, the customs and the rituals that go along with their tribal identity. So you can say nation also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that better too. Maybe we should even say that you're from Pine Ridge, and Pine Ridge is a place, for one thing, I know that it's like the poorest county in the United States. It's also a place where there's been a lot of political history, for better or worse, and where Leonard Peltier is from. So you want to talk a little bit about just a little thumbnail about the history?
History is Pine Ridge Reservation is part of the greater Lakota Nation. We have 8 reservations in South Dakota and North Dakota. And the bigger nation has 3 different dialects, Lakota, Dakota, and Nakota. And that's scattered throughout the upper Midwest and Canada. And so what the history of Pine Ridge itself is real a violent part of history also, because what the reservations were at the turn of the century were considered concentration camps. So just by the mere fact that it's called a reservation doesn't mean it's a reserve. It meant that it was reserved for Native Americans that were obviously refugees in that sense from us, but rebels back in the days when the reservations were created. And my family, we're considered as full blood, and that's really kind of like a pedigree. Also, if the United States government is trying to do something here, it's classifying us as full blood, which means that we're largely in part Native American, and so we have the nations. The Pine Ridge itself is a reservation that was reserved basically for full bloods.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. It's very interesting. Go on.
And part of what happened with the reservations is right around the late 1860s and 1870s, the gold rush started happening. They found gold in the Black Hills, right in the heart of the Lakota Nation. And therefore, the roads were opening up. The wagon trains were coming through. A lot of the history was happening, and we were considered a nation at that point by the federal government of the United States. And they were asking for rights of passage through our lands, and therefore they started creating treaties with us to say that yes, they can pass through this region. And so in that essence, we started as nation to nation status from back in those days, and to this day we're being recognized as that, a nation to nation status. President Bill Clinton just signed an order in November recognizing that nation to nation tribal status, the dialogue process that continues to this day with the United States government. So the reservations were created after some of the confrontations started happening. The confrontations, which I mean was with the soldiers, the settlers, against the Native Americans, largely that were trying to maintain their boundaries as we understood our boundaries, if there was boundaries in those days. And as those escalated and the wars continued, there was two big events that happened. One was called the Battle of the Little Bighorn, where General George Custer was killed after he tried to massacre a large encampment, a spiritual encampment of three or four different northern tribes that were practicing their spirituality or doing the spirituality ceremonies. And from there, the retaliation started. They started rounding us up and putting us onto reservations. And at this point, we were still considered nations, but they were trying to conquer us, and which in that sense, they were what's called manifest destiny, using all the tricks of a nation trying to conquer somebody. And the treaties were part of that. They signed treaties with us. They talked treaties. And then when we signed them, because we didn't speak English, a lot of those treaties were reversed or broken, saying that we didn't understand them. So that's kind of the issue that happened. But Pine Ridge itself, the violent part of the history came from after that, because of the fact that after Little Bighorn and after Custer's regiment, the 7th Cavalry, were decimated, there was another incident that happened to subdue us, which was called Wounded Knee for the Oglala Lakotas. There's other parts in the nation, the Rosebud, other tribes that that were being chased and put onto different reservations, these concentration camps that were there, designated in the worst part of the land, where nothing could grow, which they thought, in the badlands and where nobody could survive. So they put us out there hoping that we would eventually pass away and go off into history. But two things happened. There were some rebels, if you want to call us that, or savages. But there were some people that went along with the government's plan and went to the reservations, and some of our families didn't go onto the reservations. They continued fighting. They continued struggling. And one of them, and one of our very famous heroes, his name is Tashunka Witko, Crazy Horse, basically was one of the rebels that continued fighting and struggling to maintain independence and autonomy. And that's where the reservations came from. And after most of the leaders were subdued and arrested and killed, they were able to make the reservations work.
Except, with some exception, to bring it just up real quick to really recent times here, including your own personal involvement.
Well, I guess where I started getting involved is my grandpa was part of this whole process of the Lakota Nation Treaty Council, all these governing bodies that were changing and transforming from the traditional form of government to the new form of government that is in place now, which a lot of people call a puppet government. Biting to do the government's work, you know, to the point where the government is basically, the United States government is doing the policy, you know, transforming Native American lives into assimilation into the mainstream culture. But that basically was where I came in. When I was born, I guess my grandpa was doing a lot of that work, and then as I started getting older, I started seeing some of the violence being perpetrated against us, racism. And in 1973, I was 12 years old, there was another event. The second Wounded Knee happened, where the government again did a lot of attacking at us, and which was really unusual, being so supposedly living in a civil society. We've seen this growing up, and to this day, this is kind of the motion that keeps me moving in the direction of working for peace, and to understand that there's a lot of youth that really feel disenfranchised when they're coming from victims of massacre. I'm a survivor of a massacre, and I have to remember that every day. That if I'm not sitting here, if one of my grandfathers didn't fight back or didn't run, I wouldn't be sitting here. So I always have to remember I'm a survivor of a massacre. As late as 1973, there was Native Americans killed there. So I think about that, and this is part of the reason that we're doing a lot of work in Mexico. And I'll explain a little more about it as what we're doing. But as far as Mexico is concerned, there's a struggle going on in Mexico. It's very similar to what was happening here 150 years ago. Mexico prides itself on being a nation of indigenous people, mestizos. And yet, they're still killing Indian people on this continent. Mm-hmm. In Mexico, the massacres are still happening. 3 years ago, there was a massacre in a place called Acteal, in a state of Mexico called Chiapas, where there was a constant harassment and an effort to remove, again, Native Mexicans off the land, which had a lot of natural resources on it. And this started back probably in the late 80s. I mean, it's been going on, but in the late 80s, the violence towards Native communities in Mexico started escalating. And part of the reason that started happening was because of the fact that different ruling parties had been in control of the government. And at that point, they thought that they could win every possible motive to gain control of the land. So that started in the late 70s, and early on in the late 80s, some of the confrontations started happening. And in 1994, there was a group of Native Mexicans from a tribe called the Tzotzil and the Tzeltal and the Chamula. Basically, these are subgroups within a tribe of people called the Maya, just like they call us the Sioux. There's a group called a basic group called the Maya, and there's some sub-tribes within that, and these groups were part of those sub-tribes, and they very, very bluntly, they got tired of the massacres being accused or brought against them, the murders, the tortures and the harassment, and the amount of people being put in prison for trying to stand up for indigenous rights, Native Mexican rights. And for a country that prides itself on being mestizo, we felt that that was a big irony, but we again understand that a lot of it has to do with natural resources, the greed, the money that is coming into play with Mexico starting to become a world power. It's not just a third world country anymore. It's starting to become a world power because of the industry wanting to move there. And
I just want to say, too, that what happened was that the Zapatistas in Chiapas, which is what you're talking about, the organizing, took a stand on the day that NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Association, went into effect, which put, or had the threat of, and from you can tell me more about this, but I have the impression put a lot of small farmers out of business, and everybody was pretty much, people are small farmers if they're not big plantation owners. Anyway, so I remember that it was I knew about it, and it was amazing because it wasn't expected at all, and they just moved in, all these people, and took over the town of San Cristobal de Chiapas, right?
Yes, in 1994, this happened, and I was just going to get to the easy Alin. Ejército Zapatista Liberación Nacional. It means the Zapatista Liberation National Army, which is comprised of Native Mexican people. And what they did is basically they rose up in arms, basically against human rights violations. If that's all, if we can call it a war of anything, it's a war of human rights violations, a war of annihilation, of genocide again, because where they live right now, Chiapas.
And you just got back from there. I would like to let the audience know.
Oh, yes. Yes, I just recently, in fact, this past weekend, I came back into California. But I've been in Mexico for well over a month and a half. And what we're trying to build a little more of a international collaboration with the Zapatistas to get these things called the San Andres Accords. The Accords basically are a draft document of indigenous human rights in Mexico. And it doesn't cover as much as they would like it to, but at the moment that's a start for Mexico because indigenous human rights basically don't exist in Mexico. Indian people are at the bottom of any social structure in Mexico. In NAFTA, 1994, when you said NAFTA took effect, there was some... previous to that year, 1993, we started hearing a little bit of something was going to happen. And we were in Mexico doing some ceremonies, and a lot of the things that they started telling us was, yes, something's going to happen, and we need Native American participation. Native Americans from the north need to be here to start understanding what's happening in Mexico. So I was down there listening to some of this, and they were asking me to come to Mexico for New Year's, but I couldn't go. But what they said was that the EZLN was going to be, at this point, nobody heard about the EZLN. There was just an indigenous uprising. That was what they were saying. But when New Year's night, 1994, New Year's Day, they basically rose up in arms and said no more, ya basta, that we're not going to stand for this anymore. They're killing us. They're trying to move us off our land to basically turn them into refugees. And they said no. And that's what that was about. So this struggle has been going on since seven years now, 1994. And this was the seventh year, 2001, January 1st. We took a delegation of Native Americans from different nations. A lot of people call us tribes, and we'll accept that. But the nations, we went down as nations to honor these people that have been struggling for 7 years. They have not been able to celebrate any kind of New Year celebrations. And also, the Maya New Year celebration starts on another month. It's in May. It's not what the Gregorian calendar states it as, January 1st. So that's not even their New Year. And if we think about indigenous rights and culture, we have to think about the calendars. And so these people weren't even in celebration during New Year's, but this is when the world celebrates. And we went down because of the fact that during this time, Christmas, when most people are celebrating life, you know, and celebrating Jesus' life, Christianity, is when the worst things happen to Native peoples on this continent. Yeah. Wounded Knee happened in December. The forced marches for the Diné were happening in December. The Longest Walk, where the Cherokees were forced to walk off the land in North Carolina all the way to Oklahoma, Indian country, was during Christmas and New Year's. All these things happened when supposedly Christianity was supposed to be celebrating the best of their times, and yet that was forced upon us. These same cultures that left their homelands to come here to practice freedom of religion basically denied us that. Mm-hmm. And so we understood very well what the Zapatistas were going through. And December 23rd, 1997, there was a massacre in Acteal in a church, in a Christian church. And why does this happen during Christmas? We started asking ourselves. And we asked each other, you know, some of the delegate members at this point, we started asking ourselves, and a couple of years ago, how can we do something around this time to let these people know that they're not alone, and we can try to help them, as because of the fact that we have national status, and whether we look at it as a tribe within a nation, within the United States, doesn't matter. What we thought about was, these are our relatives. These are relatives. You know, we may come from the same roots, if you want to call it that. We may come from some common ancestry.
We do, for sure.
Yes. And so that's what we started thinking, is how can we go down and do this? And we started talking to people across the United States to ask each other, how can we help these people called the Zapatistas? But not just because of the Zapatistas, but because of these indigenous peoples, Indians, called Tzotzil, Tzeltal. They have names for themselves. You know, so that's the way we looked at it. So we looked at, okay, how can we do this? So we thought about it and said, well, we can go down there and honor them, you know, thank them for the struggle that they're maintaining down there, for other indigenous people, not just for their own tribes. They're doing this for a bigger picture, the bigger process of achieving peace. And Mexico right now is supposed to be a democracy, but we don't see that yet. We see massacres happening. We see murders happening. We see tortures happening. We see political prisoners being put in prison for long periods of time and never being released because of basically freedom of speech violations.
So it's happening in Mexico, just like to Leonard Peltier here in the United States.
Yes, exactly. And in fact, Leonard Peltier is very well recognized there also. The Zapatistas recognize that he is a political prisoner, wrongly accused and still in prison for that. And there's a lot of political prisoners in Mexico on the same charges. Mm-hmm. And that's part of what's going on right now. There was recently a new president that took charge of the Mexican government, President Fox, his name is. He accepted the fact that he's going to be doing some peace process work with the Zapatistas, because what we were talking about is the Zapatistas have been at war for 7 years against a bad government, against a bad force, which is, again, greed. The paramilitaries are sometimes from the same communities, the paramilitary forces that are doing the killings.
And there's, from what I hear also, there's just Chiapas is saturated with military, and some of Oaxaca, southern Mexico anyway, just there's military everywhere, really oppressing the people. And they can't plant, I've heard, and they can't harvest.
That's one of the reasons we went down there for, because we kept hearing that these people were starving and that they needed international observers to come to celebrate the New Year's with them because of the new president saying that they were going to start the peace process, the peace talks. So I think what happened was that, yes, finally they can celebrate New Year's, celebrate something after 7 years of being oppressed and repressed. So basically we went down there to celebrate with them. And we took a delegation of different tribal members from different nations, the Diné, the Lakota. Again, you know, these are two of the largest nations, and the Tohono O'odham from across the border, you know, a lot of those tribes, basically they were there before Mexico and Canada were there, or Mexico and the United States were there. The border crossed them, you know, mm-hmm. so it cut nations in half. So we took the people like that along to tell the people in Mexico and southern Chiapas that, yes, they're not alone. There's some people up here thinking about them, praying for them, and showing support. And what we hope to accomplish is to show more support to where the San Andres Accords can be accepted as a doctrine, as a document to protect indigenous human rights in Mexico. And from here, we moved to another level because we were asked, like 2 years ago, we went to a conference that was put on, sponsored by the Mexican government, the Chiapas governor at that point, who was Albores Guillen. Albores Guillen, if we're going to think about anything about what he did and remember what he did, is that he's a war criminal. He accepted the fact and probably ordered the massacre at the Actial church. And so we look at it as a war crime. You know, when a governor of a state allows this to happen and doesn't prosecute anybody, and just because they're indigenous people doesn't mean that they're at the bottom of the ladder. They did some definite human rights violations when they killed all these people.
Yeah, they were like women and children and stuff. I saw pictures. I mean, it's just horrible.
Yes. And so that's when we decided we should get involved, because these flagrant abuses of human rights, torture, death. And we figured that since part of us as Native Americans in the North that have gone through that, I remember my grandfather talking about some of those same types of abuses here in the United States. And he says, look, you know, when even as Native Americans here in the North, we have a little bit better of a life. And so what I started thinking was, how do we help them down there? What do we do? So all we can do is go down and pray with them, let them know, yes, we're with you. Whatever happens, you have our support. You can count on some of our people for money if you need money, if you need support and anything to get these San Andres Accords to the government, mm-hmm. to get them accepted. So we went down there and told them that. But also some of our tribes donated gifts to give to the Zapatistas. As indigenous people, when we say we honor somebody, we don't just say go down there and say, hey, you're great people. We sing them songs. We danced for them. We prayed with them. And we gave them gifts. From our respective nations, we gave them icons, cultural icons, that to let them know that, yes, even as indigenous people in the North, who they believe are no longer here either, they believe in Mexico that the United States people killed us off, that there are no Native Americans in the North anymore.
Oh, really?
Yes. A lot of the indigenous people there believe that there are no Native Americans left alive here, that the Americans killed us all.
You know, that myth is perpetrated about a lot of different countries, I've noticed. That's interesting. I mean, that what does that accomplish?
That accomplishes erasure of history. Neglect. By neglect, what I mean by that is the fact that if you erase somebody's history, no, you don't have to think about it.
Yeah, true.
So what happened was we heard it here in the United States too. Mexico supposedly has no native people left alive after the conquest, after the Spaniards came to Mexico. And yet, that's what's taught in the history books. And yet, today, there's indigenous people speaking their languages. They have their cultures that are very much alive.
There's a lot of languages, actually, in Mexico. And just in Chiapas, right, there's like 19 or something. And you yourself, Willie Underbaggage, you speak some languages from Mexico, too, some indigenous languages.
Yes. First of all, we speak with this tongue I'm speaking in now. And there's another language called Spanish that it hears on this continent. To us, those are foreign languages. And I speak a native language called Lakota. But also I'm learning another native language of Mexico, which is Nahuatl, which basically the word Mexico is Nahuatl. It's not Spanish. Mm-hmm. So if you think about Spanish in Mexico, it's not all totally Spanish. It's intermixed with many, many different tribes there. So that's kind of what we're getting at, is that, yes, there are some very viable nations in Mexico. And what's happened with our delegation trip to Chiapas this year, after New Year's, we sat down and talked to some of the leaders of the struggle. And they asked us to promote a peace conference to bring native tribes from across this continent together into Mexico, into La Realidad, which is where the struggle is basically the strongest in Chiapas. They would like us to come there and sit down and dialogue, and how can we offer what we have here, reservations, even if that's what it is. They have to get their boundaries. They have to strengthen their treaties, which is the San Andrés Accord. So we delivered some documents, our treaties that we have with the United States government. And in that sense, we hope that they can strengthen their documents and continue being nations with their languages, with their identity, with their songs, their ceremonies. So we sat and we talked to them, and we told them, yes, you know, we are still alive. We are there supporting you. We are praying for your people. And what can we do? And there's a couple of things that are happening right now with the Zapatistas, which they're doing a mobilization from Chiapas to the capital, which is Mexico City. And they're doing a spiral, like the form of a seashell. They're going to leave Chiapas and go up through Veracruz, Hidalgo, Querétaro, to Michoacán, south around through Milpa Alta, and then into Mexico City. But before that, they're going to stop in a place called Nurio, Michoacán, to dialogue. They're going to stop and dialogue with all the other native Mexican tribes March 2nd, 3rd, and 4th. So that's the next process that's happening in this peace process. So we're still involved in that, and I will be going back down there to continue more of the work here and bring back more information and news, actually.
That's great. The movement is growing as a movement. That's so important that we join together. Well, Willie Underbates, you know, folks, it's time to get your pencils. If you want to get in touch with Willie, it's the usual end of the show, contact time. So, Willie, I know you're on the move all the time, so you say that the email is best for you to be contacted.
Yes, email is probably the best thing. I have a pager number, but I'm traveling throughout the United States right now, so it's very hard to reach me. So indigenousnationsnetwork@lakota.cc is one of the easiest ways to reach me. And again, my personal email is williechili@hotmail.com. It's WillyChili. And I have a pager that I travel with, and I'm being here in California for a few weeks, so it's 415-790-0532. And I can be reached through Pacific News Service also.
Well, that's a lot of possibilities for somebody who's moving around all the time. I want to thank you very much and wish you the very best in this project. It's very, very excellent. Thanks, Willie Underbaggage. And my name's Sue Supriano. Thanks for listening.